children time to awake from your sleep. Rise to a new day with each a soul to keep.
Hello and welcome to the Enlightened Medicine Show with Dr. Valerie Olmsted, the holographic physician. And you guys are going to love this tonight. Tonight we have David Sarita on, and we're going to talk about a whole lot of really interesting things. But before I really get him to do his bio, I would like to first mention that next week we're going to have Marjorie on telling you what is so special about the Hydramay lotion that I'm always talking about. And remember that Hydramay is our sponsor. And so we're going to talk about why it's special and why it soaks in and all that kind of stuff. So she's going to be on for a few minutes at the beginning. Okay, now let's get to today. So David Sarita has made some really interesting movies. You've probably heard about them or seen them. There's Water and The Voice and Mona Lisa's Little Secret and a number of other books, including Singularity. And so David is going to be telling you all kinds of things. You might want to take some notes. He's pretty interesting. Welcome to the show, David.
Thanks for having me on your show, Valerie.
Well, you know, you're so fascinating. And remember, when I first met you, I said that I manifested you because when I first heard you speak, I wanted to meet you because you have actually been one of those people who has talked with the one we call Jesus. And so I'm sure that the listeners would love to hear about this. And I was just thrilled, as you know, to meet someone else who had that experience also. And I'm guessing that your lifelong meditative practice is what kind of took you down this whole road of these incredible movies and books that you're doing. And so I'm just going to let you go and do your own bio. How about that?
Well, you know, I grew up I was actually born in Alberta, Canada, in August of 1961. And we moved to Berkeley, you know, the Berkeley campus. And my dad was getting his PhD in psychology there. We were there in 1964, four brothers, my mom, Linda, and my dad, you know, Win Sarita. And we're growing up in the middle of the riots, you know, all the Vietnam, you know, anti-war protests. It's a big changing time in America. And I remember this so well. The tear gas riots and not being able to see, and my mom dragging us through all this. And in the midst of all this, my mom divorces my real father, and I'm raised by a science teacher named Dave Cooper. Mm-hmm. We moved to Modesto, California, where he teaches science, and then my mom divorces him many years later, and I go back to my psychologist father, who's into yoga and meditation and all these cool things and vegetarianism. And I had just come from science and baseball and, you know, being a Little League and knew nothing about consciousness. And I was very resistant at first, and my father took me to a yoga retreat by force to see an Indian mystic named Baba Haridas and to learn yoga and meditation. And he thought it would help heal me because most, you know, my brothers and I all cried for years over being separated from our mother, who had to go to law school and, you know, become independent financially, and she eventually became a lawyer in the state of California. And we just missed our mother. I was crying, like, all the time, and I developed lumps in my chest. And my dad thought that this practice of meditation would help, and I really didn't want to know anything about this stuff. I just wanted to go back to my mother with my brothers, and I didn't want any of this spiritual stuff. And I was baptized Catholic in Alberta, in Canada, in the early 60s. And our family didn't practice Catholicism. So eventually what happens is I start to have mystical experiences in the presence of some of these meditation masters. And I'm very impressed by these experiences. In fact, my very first mystical experience at a yoga retreat in the interior of British Columbia, I'm sleeping in a tent all by myself. I'm probably 13 years old or so, and I feel this paralysis crawling up my legs, and my legs get physically paralyzed in the tent, and I'm not screaming for help. I'm really feeling this energy is enveloping me. And then it paralyzes my waist, and then my arms, and then my neck, and then it felt like someone was strangling me. And any, you know, normal person would think, you know, this is like a possession or something like that. But I didn't feel any negative energy. I actually felt a really nice energy paralyzing me. So I relaxed into it. And all of a sudden, in this blinding blue light, I see these three beings. And one of them is a half monkey, half human. And there's all these glowing gems and jewels all over the crown of this monkey man. And then there's this unbelievably beautiful East Indian woman and a man who are so radiant, I fall on the ground in this vision. And I can't physically, with all my might, push my body off the ground. And their light is so powerful, I'm just blinded in this beautiful blue light, and I'm looking. I remember the gems in the third eye of the woman and the man were alive. They were not like our gems on Earth. And they were so powerful. The next morning, I told the guru in front of several hundred students what had happened, and he just laughed, and he said that was Hanuman, the Hindu deity Hanuman that I saw. And I said, who's Hanuman? And then, who were the other two? And so one of the students took me over to a painting, my first Krishna painting I've ever seen, and showed me this monkey god who's half monkey and man, Hanuman. And next to him were Rama and Sita, which apparently are always with Hanuman. And they are supremely, supremely, at the very least, enlightened beings in the East Indian tradition. And I never heard of them. So because I never heard of them, I knew that I had had a really profound experience. And that day changed my life. I eventually, by the time I was 18, I was practicing meditation every single day. And I kept meditating, and by the time I was later in my 18th year, I began working as a tree planter in the forest of British Columbia, you know, strapping, 200 trees around my waist, working for companies. And over 22 years, I planted over 1.3 million trees in my life from the Alaskan Panhandle. I've seen every inch of forest, from Vancouver Island, the interior of British Columbia, to the north, to the south. And I really enjoyed being a tree planter. It was a very hard work considering the economy, very low pay. I could never afford to buy a house or anything like that. And I just loved it. I loved serving. I loved doing my yoga and my meditation. And then my father led an Buddhist intensive meditation retreat, where it was the first time I did an intensive, where we actually sat in the Buddha posture, not leaning against the wall, very, very hard to hold the body straight, 12 hours a day. You sit for an hour, and your back is killing. You get up, you stretch your legs, you walk in slow motion, and then you go back to sitting. And then, eventually you have tea breaks and lunch breaks. But by the end of the day, you're exhausted with pain, and my legs were killing me. It felt like someone beat me up.
I did.
A 2x4. And I said, one of my friends was at the retreat, Mike. He crawled out of the basement window because he couldn't take the pain. So, sitting there facing yourself in meditation all day is probably physically the hardest thing I've ever done. And I've skydived from 24,000 feet. I planted trees. I was an extreme skier. I've jumped 30-foot cliffs on skis. And I've done all these insane sports, extreme adrenaline sports. And nothing is harder than meditating all day, and nothing is more rewarding. Like, if I compared the high that I got from extreme skiing or skydiving, including high-altitude skydiving and night skydiving, and nothing compares to what you get when you meditate properly. So at this retreat, on the second day, I was in so much pain, I was really doubting what I was doing. And this, all of a sudden, this explosion of ecstasy started in my belly. It was so beautiful, peaceful, blinding light of ecstasy. And I burst out laughing. I was fighting to stop the laughter because I didn't want to wake up the other meditators. There was 30 people meditating. And I left the room, and I went outside, and I went to the park. And it's like I didn't have a body. Most of my consciousness was beyond the body. I was the universe. I was hearing the sounds of every plant, every blade of grass, and these two willow trees were blowing in the wind. And I was laughing because I was the tree. I could feel the wind touching the leaves as if it was my own body. And when these crows were walking on the grass, it was tickling me. I was laughing hysterically. I was the whole universe. I could hear everything, feel everything. And the physical sensations were there, but they were very faint, whereas now, when I'm not in meditation, the physical sensations take up most of my consciousness. And then I look up at the sun, and I went, oh, my God, I can hear the sun. It's chanting this deep hum and all these beautiful frequencies and high frequency sounds are coming out of the sun. And it was an incredibly cosmic experience. So that day convinced me that this meditation path was the most valuable thing I could be doing with my time. And I meditated with my first girlfriend. Sometimes we would sit 6 hours a day, sometimes 4 hours a day, and then we'd be tree planting, and then we would be meditating during those periods. And then eventually I lost my first love when I was 21, and I continued to meditate and study with many different meditation masters. I mean, I've studied with a lot of the well-known gurus from the Far East, and I lived with Osho and his community for a year. I studied with Swami Sham, and I've met, the mother who hugs you, Ma Amrita Anandamaya Ma. I've met the mother Mira, who is probably my favorite, one of my favorite saints in the world right now. I mean, the list is too long. I went to India. I studied with the Dalai Lama and did his 7-day, intensive. And I practiced with many Buddhist masters, Native Americans. And my practice has just deepened and deepened and deepened. And 1987, 2 days before Christmas, 86, December 22nd and 23rd, I had probably the most powerful cosmic experience of my entire life, which is in my film, The Voice. It's at the end of the film, The Voice. And because one of the reasons I put it there is I really wanted to tell the story of what is the total human potential and what is authentic enlightenment. What is this word enlightenment? What does it mean? And what can meditation really give us? And what can prayer give us? And in this experience, all of a sudden at 4:15 in the afternoon on December 22nd, I felt like I was being paralyzed again. I was dying. My muscles started shaking. I felt like, oh my God, there's something wrong with you. Oh my God, you better lie down. So I lie down, and this is in Vancouver, and it's pouring rain and very dark and gloomy weather up there in the Northwest. And all of a sudden, I'm out of body almost instantly, and I see this old man. I'm in this house. And it's not like a dream where you wait a long time and you start dreaming. This was instant. Mm-hmm. And this old man was dying, and these two girls with long brown hair and white robes were praying over his body like he was a saint or something. And I thought, he's dead. I mean, he's pale. And the walls of his home were very poor, very, very poor, very humble man. And he gets up as if he's not dead. And he looks at me with all this enthusiasm, and he said, do you want to see an angel? And the second I said yes, thundering, death, it was like a crackle of thunder. White light just shines down from above in the heavens, and angels are singing, millions of times louder than thunder or Beethoven's Ninth Symphony. And the music behind the angels was so unbelievably beautiful that it put Beethoven to shame by millions or billions of times. And this angel singing, and in this light was so much power, it got so bright it dissolved the walls of the house. And the light was so strong, it was paralyzing us. The two women fell on the ground and couldn't move. I fell on the ground. The old man was gone. And it was just light everywhere. And thunderous angels with the voices unimaginable. No ecstasy, nothing but the fear of God was in me. And as I fell on the ground, paralyzing, I was aware on the bed again in the room that my legs were paralyzing. My waist, and then my arms, and then my neck. I was weakened. I was totally destroyed by this power. And all of a sudden, my neck, it felt like I was being choked to death, and I just surrendered. I said, obviously, these are God's angels. There's nothing to fear. Mm-hmm. And the moment I let go of fear, even the fear of God, that I was in the presence of the Creator, all of a sudden, this explosion of ecstasy had started in the belly again. It was so bright, I mean, it made my experience in meditation look like nothing. I mean, it was like millions of bliss balls of ecstasy just exploding out. And I went shooting above my body through the roof, above the city of Vancouver, into the cosmos. And, oh my God, where I was going, it was incredible. And I could see that as I went above the earth, all of a sudden I could see hundreds of thousands of silvery gray cocoons. And the cocoons were the souls of the departed on Earth. And I could see little lights flickering inside of them, and they were dreaming their dreams. Just like if we picture an apple or an orange, we picture it on the screen of our mind. And the silvery gray color, I noticed, was the same color that people described the tunnel in the near-death experience and the pinhole of light at the end of the tunnel. Well, these cocoons were their own tunnels. These souls were all trapped in the cocoons. And then I could see that the polarity matrix of positive and negative, or good and evil, was keeping this spherical more, it's not a perfect sphere. It's really a kind of an oblong shape that each soul was trapped in. And they couldn't go into the light. They were afraid of it. And as this angel of light appeared off to my left, and I came close to the cocoons, he said, "They're not ready yet. They're too afraid. They're not ready to be cracked open and humiliated like the death that I had to go through before I went into this light." And the angel singing above was so beautiful. There was so much. The levels of ecstasy were, and love and peace and beauty were a million times beyond the best relationship or the best moment I've ever experienced in the human body. And all of a sudden, they started carrying me upwards towards the center of the galaxy. And I actually started approaching what looked like a giant glass membrane or barrier, which I was told by the light was the end of the first heaven, the first clear light heaven. And the angel told me that the first heaven had millions of paradise planets inside of it in the galaxy. It was just a higher dimension of our galaxy. And these paradise planets were for all the souls who could attain this first heaven. And as I went through the membrane, the ecstasy was crushing me. It was like too much joy, too much bliss. And the angel singing got louder. And as I pierced the membrane, I went into the second heaven, and my body was somehow more purified and attuned, and I could bear another million times more ecstasy and love and peace and power and beauty in the second heaven. The angel singing got louder and more beautiful, and I was really blown away. I was moving through this heaven at you know, superluminal, beyond light speed travel, and I was told there were millions of paradise planets in this heaven. And I was already convinced that I was experiencing more lighter enlightenment than I ever thought, you know, anybody could possibly bear. There's no way the human really deserved this. I thought, oh my God, is this what we all deserve? We all deserve this absolute perfection. Mm-hmm. I could see through every atom in my body. If I pointed my finger towards a planet or a star, it was like a telescope. I could see that planet and that star, and we were flying through this universe. And then I went through another membrane, and the ecstasy crushed me. It became unbearable, and I went into the third. And the third heaven was the end of the last stage of being human. It was, my body was so bright, and the ecstasy levels were another million times greater than the second. It's exponential. And the love and the peace and the power and the beauty and the angel singing was, this was the point where I said to God, stop, I can't go any further. I can't go any further now. And then it didn't matter what I said. God was going to take me higher. I went through another membrane. I went into the fourth, and I was now a sphere that was, I don't know, I mean, thousands of feet wide. I no longer had arms and legs. I wasn't human anymore. I was a cosmic sphere, and I was zooming through the third heaven, and I was told there were millions of paradise planets here. But in this heaven, all of the beings and enlightened masters in it were spherical. There was no more form that was human. And then I went into the fourth. And the fourth is, I mean, and the fifth. I went into the fifth. I went through another membrane. And the fifth is the beginning. It's just unspeakable. There were qualities in the fifth that made ecstasy look utterly boring. They were very feminine graces. They were clearly the feminine aspects of God, and they were too many different types of graces to even name, and every one of them made all the preceding qualities look insignificant. Love and ecstasy were things of the past. These graces were beyond everything. And then I went into the sixth, and it's simply unimaginable that this is this is everybody's potential, that every single human being will eventually live in these heavens. Mm-hmm. And then I approached the seventh, and it was, the light told me that if I cross the seventh, I'll never be able to come back. And it would be the end of my journey if I crossed that point of being human. I would never be able to make that connection again. And it was that point that I turned back, and I decided I want to tell everybody the kingdom of heaven is real, and in those higher heavens, I could see the angels' voices were causing the galaxies and the planets and the subatomic particle spins to be born. Their voices were spinning vortexes of music that were sustaining the creation and feeding it, and their singing wasn't purposeless. It wasn't like the Vienna Boys Choir that was singing to uplift you. Their voices were the cause of all the cosmic spins in creation. And then what happened when I came back is I told my brother and my dad what happened. I was so blown away. I retained none of the ecstasy, none of the qualities. It's like instantly a quadrillion, billion candlelight power was turned off, and I was in this dark planet again.
Mm-hmm.
And then the next day, December 23rd, 1986, it happened again. And I went through all the heavens. I was shown my previous lifetimes, my very last life. I only lived to be about 3 years old. I was a Tibetan Buddhist boy who was massacred in the 1950s in the Chinese invasion of Tibet. And then I went through all the levels of light, and they took me to the seventh again, where I decided not to cross. So I don't cross, and I ended up going to International Association for Near-Death Studies meetings for, you know, over almost a decade, meeting people who had near-death experiences. No meditation could ever do that again. It doesn't matter how much I practiced, I would reach, you know, great states of peace and feeling good, but nothing could compare to this. And I went to India in 1996 and studied with the Dalai Lama, and I was starting to search for the answer to my experience of, you know, where was I? I asked a young Rinpoche in India, and he didn't know where I was. And then I find Buddha's Lankavatara Sutra, which is one of the most important Tibetan Buddhist sutras, where Buddha describes that it took him 400 lifetimes to perfect samadhis 1 through 6. In each of these samadhis is like a level of enlightenment. But Buddha warned that the samadhis 1 through 6, which is exactly what I experienced, were all impermanent, meaning you could experience them, get illuminated, and then you go back to normal.
Mm-hmm.
But Buddha said the only permanent realization is that it starts at the 7th, which is where I didn't go.
Mm-hmm.
And Buddha said that in order to get to the 7th, he had spent 400 lifetimes perfecting 1 through 6. He was born Prince Siddhartha, having had attained the 6th in his previous incarnations, but now he had attained nirvana, and there are 3 nirvanas in the Lankavatara Sutra, and the first nirvana is the 7th. And Buddha attains the 7th, and then he teaches literally, probably thousands of students to attain the 7th, which is nirvana. So what I'm describing is something that's happened to many, many Buddhist masters, many Hindu masters, many, in fact, Dante Alighieri, the Italian poet, goes all the way to the 9th, which would be the equivalent of the 3rd nirvana for the Buddhist.
Mm-hmm.
What I'm describing is something that has happened to many, many beings. But those who attain the 7th reach permanent realization. And Buddha said in order to do that, you have to come all the way down out of all that bliss. And he said some monks and nuns get trapped in these spheres of superlight when they die, thinking they've attained nirvana, and they haven't. They have to come all the way down and do something to serve humanity, to help uplift humanity, and then they gain the grace to enter the 7th, 8th, and 9th.
Mm-hmm.
So the answer to where I was really clear, and what I've been doing with my life is serving and doing environmental work and healing work and trying to find ways to serve in the upliftment of humanity. So when I made my film, The Voice, I made a film that was merging science and the true vision of the 7 levels of the superfields of consciousness,
mm-hmm.
that were everybody's potential to give people an insight and a vision to what, if they do this practice and they live this spiritual life, this is what you can attain in case you're interested. And we put, you know, professors like Gary Schwartz from Harvard Yale, professor who's describing consciousness, Roger Nelson, who's the director of the Princeton University Global Consciousness Project, Jeffrey Long, who's the head of the Near Death Experience Research Foundation, he's a radio oncologist, medical doctor, Mylise Abson, who's a plant researcher. We have all these amazing researchers in the film. We have Robert Thurman, who translated the Tibetan Book of the Dead, is considered one of the greatest scholars in Tibetan Buddhism. I mean, incredible people are in this mini-series, 3-hour-long DVD that I have at voiceentertainment.net, and people, you can get it on Netflix, The Voice. You can search on Netflix and rent it. And it's, you know, two films that are an hour and a half each that by the end, the science is there to prove that these fields of consciousness are really scientifically verifiable. And then that you can actually experience these fields of consciousness. And as you attain each level of the field, what scientist Lynn McTaggart, her book The Field, is proving that this field is alive, it's real, we're doing experiments with the field. I believe her science has touched the first field, but she hasn't. Science has not been able to go beyond that yet. It's not at this point, anyway.
Mm-hmm.
But that what's so amazing to me is, you know, I've been doing this meditation for years and years and years, and that this has happened. You know, I'm one person telling a story about the seven levels of the superfield, but it has been crossed by thousands of Buddhists. Probably thousands of Christians and Jews and Muslims and Hindus and even probably agnostics and Zen masters. This is what that experience is like. So when I hear people say, oh, heaven's going to be boring and they're just going to be playing music and you really want to go to the parties in hell, these people know nothing. What the saints have, what they're experiencing, St. Teresa of Avila describing the seven levels of the interior castle, this is what they're experiencing. And once you have that kind of access in the cosmos, nobody can give you anything that's going to compare to it. I mean, a fancy car and a mansion, you know, nice to live in, but nothing can touch this stuff. Buddha was born a prince in a palace who had every luxury there was, beautiful women, jewelry, palatial, you know, headquarters. He left all of it. His wife, Yasodhara, whom he was married to, as soon as Buddha left the palace and left her with their son, Rahula, she shaves her head, strips her body of all her jewelry, and she practices meditation while Buddha's in the forest, but she's staying at home with the baby, raising the child, right?
Mm-hmm.
And when Buddha comes back, the first thing he does after he's attained the seventh, he's in nirvana, which is permanent. This state never leaves you when you attain the nirvana. Well, he wants to see his wife, Yasodhara. It's so beautiful when his father shows him Yasodhara, you know, she falls at his feet like Mary Magdalene did to Jesus, cries her eyes out, and they're in this beautiful communion. And within a very short time, she attains the seventh. She attains nirvana.
Mm.
And their son becomes a monk. In fact, she becomes the first head of the feminine Buddhist order, the first nun. And when I think of that, I think I couldn't, when I was at the seventh, it's already unbelievable just to be in the third, let alone we're talking about the seventh, because you're talking supernovas of ecstasy and love, and the graces just make even all that unspeakably boring. Then when you cross the seventh, it's a million times with the sixes at least. And I've never crossed that point since, and I'm sure, you know, one day, once I've done enough service to humanity and work, eventually I will. I don't know when, how long it'll be, but yeah, this is.
Yeah,
this
I don't think it's a time thing. I don't think it's a time thing, David.
Mm-hmm.
And the reason I say that is because when I had my experiences, I certainly didn't have, you know, the training that you had or anything like that. I was meditating 6 or 7 hours a day when I had my first real experience, conscious near-death experience. But after that, when I started attaining the different levels, it was through fasting and cleansing. And I meditated every day, but just for a short time. And what I was doing was sitting in lotus position and just letting the kundalini rise by itself. But I was contemplating different virtues. And at one point, I used to have the angels come and take me all over the place. And I love it when you talk about the sound of the voices of the angel and being one with everything, because that's an experience that you really have to experience. And I remember at one point I got taken out and I was way out in the cosmos, and I was approaching what all I could call it was God, but it was a pink cloud. It was white in the center and pink on the edges. And I was like a little dot, so I was, you know, the spherical being, floating towards it. And as I got at the very, very fringe edges of that, where there had to be miles between me and the next little sphere, I went into complete bliss and lost consciousness and had no idea if I was ever coming back, and I didn't care. And the next morning, I woke up and found myself back in the body going, wow, that was interesting. I didn't think I was coming back. And that is so much fun. I mean, the bliss just made me go completely, completely detached from my experience here on Earth. So I find
the Buddhists call nirvana a total eradication of suffering, and literally it gets so transcendent that, for example, and the Hindus know this and they say this, in the higher samadhis, if you put nails through, you know, Jesus' wrist, he won't feel a thing. And I actually saw this it wasn't 60 Minutes, it was one of those programs where the news anchor was in the middle of this Muslim ceremony, and they were piercing their bodies with swords and you know, sharp objects, and as if nothing was happening. Like, the look on these people's faces was like, we don't even feel this. And then the news anchor was going to put a needle through his hand, his palm, or his finger, and he was really scared, and he did it, and he said he couldn't feel a thing inside of this field. So we think of Jesus on the cross, and there's actually a gospel called the Acts of John that was outlawed by Pope Leo the Great because it describes Jesus appearing to John while he's being crucified and telling John that, I'm dancing right now. I don't feel anything. I'm beyond the body. I'm not this body. I'm not on that wooden cross. That's just the body. And yeah, the body is reacting and it's bleeding and it's probably shivering and quivering, but he's not perceiving that because in this super luminal light, there is no physical gross sensation. But Jesus suffers for humanity. He suffers in compassion for the fact that we did this to him, and that's what we do to each other. We crucify each other. We go to war with each other in the name of God, of all things, thinking that our religion is better than the other religion. And yet, so there is a suffering for all humanity, but it's not physical. And then we see that all the world religions, they have different languages to describe these 7 to 9 levels of the superfield, but they're all extant in our literature. You will see the Buddhists describe the 9 or 8 to 9 levels as jhana, and the Hindus call it samadhi, and then the Muslims, you know, Muhammad ascends to the 7th heaven, and he wants to go to the heavens higher, but he can't, and he waits until God takes him. Dante describes it going to the 9th. And you see this consistently for the Hindus, for everybody. And for the Jews, you've always had the 8 or 9 levels of the angelic kingdom, and the 8 or 9 levels of the angels have been around, you know, since the time of the Jews and the early Christians. So you see that magic number 9. It's everywhere. But it's in a different language. So we all think that, you know, those who were less educated in their religion, that our religion is better than yours, and we, you know, our God is the one true God and yours isn't. But really, God at this point is not the body and the form, it's the unnameable field, the light itself. The whole thing is God. And it's ineffable, it's inconceivable. And in fact, when Dante, if you read the Divine Comedy, which is one of the most amazing things I've read, when he actually makes it to the 9th heaven, which I've never heard any saint of any religion actually describe what it's like to even be in the 9th, let alone the 7th. And when he's there, all of the saints are meditating, gazing upon the Virgin Mary, who is the only one who can perpetually gaze at Christ, because no one can survive a direct gaze at Christ in the 9th sphere. And eventually, St. Bernard of Clairvaux takes Dante by the hand, and he says, it's your turn, because you've been meditating, preparing yourself by gazing upon the Virgin Mary. You're now ready to try to gaze at Christ. And when Dante stands up and gazes at Christ, Christ transfigures into this sphere. And blinding, super cosmic light. And Dante falls. He doesn't last very long looking at him, but before he falls, Jesus shows him 9 more virgin spheres above that no one has ever trespassed. Not a single soul has gone beyond the 9th, because no one can attain beyond that. But as soon as someone's ready, they're there for the taking, but right now they're virgin, they're untouched. And so what it shows is God is evolving too. As we get into higher and higher realization, we never actually attain the absolute, because the absolute creates higher heavens, higher spheres of consciousness, in case you're interested.
Right.
And it's just unimaginable to even think of what it's like to even be in the ninth, let alone to gaze at Christ in that ninth sphere and realize that he is still far beyond the vision. And
you know, I can kind of relate to that, because I know the first time that Christ appeared to me, I fell. I could not look at him at all.
Oh, no.
And it was just so amazing, because all I got from that wonderful, incredible being was just love, absolute, unconditional, intense, and absolutely pure love. And it was like, oh my God, you can't even start to describe to somebody what that feels like, because we feel it so little here on Earth.
And, yeah, we suffer so much here.
Yeah.
But the thing is, so many people, and this was another motivation for making my film The Voice, was take another look, people. Look deep inside of your own religion. I mean, I'm not making a movie to try to convert you to one religion or the other. Look at all of them, and you'll see that there are sacred practices in every religion, that if you do these practices and you live this life faithfully, you too will have this exact same experience. You can transcend suffering. You can attain this bliss. It doesn't matter how bad your past was, how much you suffer now, this is actually attainable. You know, I had my experience. That was 7 years into my daily practice when I had that experience. And the experiences I have now, I met Jesus in person in 1994, and I could barely look at him for a second each glance. I was falling on my face, and the levels of cosmic love and ecstasy and graces, and it was imperceptible. I would hide my face from him and look and hide my face, because it was too powerful.
Oh,
and the
yeah.
first words he said to me as I was holding his feet were, "I have appeared to a number of people throughout the universe, but at different levels of their spiritual ability. No one has ever seen me in my entirety. It is not possible at this time." And he said, "Even now, you are not seeing me in my entirety. It's not possible."
Mm-hmm.
And then later, when I read the Gnostic literature, in fact, in the Gospel of Philip, Jesus says, Jesus appeared to them all. He appeared to the great as the great, and the small as small. He appeared to everyone, even though his true power hid itself. It's something like that. Actually, he says, Jesus took them all by stealth, for he did not appear as he was, but in a manner in which they would be able to see him. And when Jesus was in front of me, he was showing me that he actually has to lower the totality of the God vibration, which is not male or female. It's beyond all the human stuff.
Absolutely.
And Jesus is showing that literally the vibration of God has to be lowered so that a human can perceive it. But even then, it blows us away. We can't look like what you experienced. And even that is nothing. That's how much it humbles us. So, the ineffable vision of God is untouchable. It is beyond the scope of any human vision. As Dante experiences it, it is beyond the ninth sphere, and no humans, no angel has even trespassed up there. There's no being other than the virgin purity of God that is at that level. And when you see this, and you see that this is in Buddhism, it's in Hinduism, and we think, why are we fighting? Why are we going to war with each other in such arrogance to think that our God is better than the other? It's ridiculous.
Yeah. I've never understood that myself, and I used to get my knuckles wrapped all the time in Catholic school for that opinion.
Mm-hmm.
Because I kept saying, you know, how can you say that God favors some of his children over the others when,
yeah.
you know, it says right here in the book that God loves all of his creation.
Yeah.
It didn't make any sense to me, and it makes even less sense to me now. You know, now that I've had my experiences, and I got to tell you, you know, there's times when it's very difficult to be here, even in service, because, you know, you think about, wow, you know, there I was out there in unconditional love, you know, and I knew everything, and I was everything at once, and I chose to come back here. What am I, nuts? You know,
well, that's where it gets really ironic, because even in the Christian Gnostic literature, when Jesus is describing the fall to John in what's called the Apocryphon of John, In the Apocryphon of John, Jesus transfigures or shapeshifts 550 days after the crucifixion. And John is grieving in the desert and crying, and he's been fasting, and the Jews have been mocking him, saying, "This Nazarene deceived you." And Jesus appears in this blinding light, and the sound is deafening, just like what I experienced.
Mm-hmm.
And Jesus says, "John, John, why do you doubt or why are you afraid? That is, do not be timid. I am the one who is with you always. I am the Father. I am the Mother. And I am the Son." And he shapeshifts into the Mother, and then into the Son, and then into the old man with the white beard,
mm-hmm.
the Ancient of Days. And then he shows John that when humans were created, after the taking of the knowledge of good and evil, which is judgment and conflict and war, this seed was planted in the actual flesh. And with this seed, you can actually attain this liberation, this enlightenment. And for the Buddhists, they actually, in their reincarnation knowledge, they actually avoid reincarnating in pleasure realms because the human condition, which has suffering in it, like, for example, a person could be in the fifth, you know, clear light heaven, you know, when they die, but they'll never get the seventh, which is permanent realization, unless they go back into that flesh and suffer, because inside the suffering is compassion. And it's from compassion that we eventually attain, you know, the seventh, eighth, and ninth. And we can't, according to Buddha, there are thousands or millions of souls that are in these super light fields, and they eventually get bored of them. In fact, Robert Thurman describes this in my film, The Voice, that, yes, it's easy to attain these lights when you die, but eventually you will get bored of these lights, these super lumen states, and you'll want to come and suffer again and be human so that you can attain nirvana. So if you look in the Christian Gnostic literature, you'll see the same language, that there's something about this birth. It's very hard to be here. The suffering is intense, but if we break and leave, or we, you know, we decide, I don't want to be here anymore, like two of my friends have done, have taken their lives, you go into the light, but then eventually you have to come back and suffer again until you evolve to a higher and higher level of light. And the light matures at the seventh level, and that's the moment we graduate, according to the Buddha and according to the Hindus, that when you attain the seventh, which is what Muhammad attained and what Buddha attained and so forth, that is the moment where you're free. That's the moment where you are now a super cosmic being. You don't have to come back here in the school anymore. So,
right,
it's
but
ironic
they still
because,
do sometimes.
Yes, you know what I'm saying? It's very ironic. We have to suffer.
Yep.
To
and
get
we have to provide service. And that's something
and we
that.
Service.
Yeah, that's something that's a hard concept to get across to people, because they either go overboard and they give themselves away and they don't stand up for themselves, and that's not what it's about. Or they don't do enough, you know, and they want too much money for it. And so, you know, there's this happy medium where you're serving because you're basically guided to do that particular thing. And it's not about, you know, if you get famous or if you get money or anything like that. It's really about being there to help other people to reach the next stage for whatever it is for them. So
yeah.
that they can, you know, keep on moving towards that. And one of my teachers, my favorite teacher of all time, was Torquem Ceredarian. And Torquem said, you know, he said, Jesus was a Capricorn. And everybody's like, oh, yeah, right, you know, he's born on Christmas. And he said, no, it's not that. He said the Capricorn is the creature who is the highest part of, he said, the tripartite creature. But he said the Capricorn is the unicorn that has the single eye. And he said it's all about that single eye that goes to heaven, attains enlightenment, and turns around and shines their light upon the world in order to help the rest of the beings to move along that same path. And I always remembered that. And I thought, you know, that's so amazing. And if you look at the life of the one that we call Jesus, you see that. I mean, amazingly. And he just keeps helping and keeps coming. And yes, his, you know, Father, Son, and Holy Spirit all at once. But if you could even get a portion of that across to people, and this is why I'm so excited about your movies, because getting that across to somebody is such a powerful thing, and you're the right person to do it because of your experiences and because you retained the knowledge of what was going on. And, I mean, that's one thing that impressed me, because I just went into bliss and I didn't remember anything beyond that. I know there was more.
The way I look at it, Valerie, is I'm really nothing. I mean, this has been done before. You know, when I think mm-hmm. of, you know, how beautiful it was to be even in the third heaven, which was where I was the most comfortable, because the levels of ecstasy beyond that were way over my abilities, in my opinion. But thousands and thousands of Buddhists, Muslims, Hindus, and Christians, and Jews, and people of religions we don't even know the name for, have done this before. Mm-hmm. They have crossed it. But what I feel has happened is humanity and Hollywood have lost sight of what this is. Mm-hmm. Our religions have become very corrupt. Our churches have become very corrupt with, you know, abuses in the Catholic Church and money abuse. I mean, money is not evil. Money is just energy. In fact, when people even say to me, you know, like, why don't you put your film for free? I'll say, do you think the church is free? Do you know how much that building costs that you're standing in, and the people who work behind it, and how many billions of dollars there are in the church?
Uh-huh.
It's not money that's evil. It's what it's doing. Money is
exactly.
just a unit of energy. It's like a quantified unit of energy. So if you're making money in a film or healing technologies, that's still service.
Mm-hmm.
And the people who do this need to get paid so they can live and have a roof over their head. The church is a roof over the priest's head and the pope's head, and it costs a lot of money. It wasn't free. So,
yeah, that's for sure.
So I don't have a problem with that. But then when you look at, yeah, Jesus served, and he continues to serve through his saints and through his presence and his appearances. I mean, I know probably tens of people like you and myself who have had meetings with Christ, but does it make the news? No. It doesn't make a film. And yet, when you go to these meetings, like IAM's meetings, near-death experience, there are dozens and dozens of people who have met Christ like we have. So,
sure.
To me, it's not about, it's about communicating through film that people are having these experiences, and you can too. And all you have to do is get back in touch with the mystic practices in your own religion. Upon seeing Christ, I accepted him as God. To me, he's the most supreme being I've ever seen, next to all the beings I've met from India, who are wonderful saints and are great teachers, and I don't judge anybody, but Jesus to me is the king. But,
oh, yeah.
And that's my opinion, my humble opinion, that he is God, God in the flesh, mm-hmm. you know, the masculine, the feminine, and beyond the masculine and feminine. And I've made that point
he's the closest one we can get to.
And yet people are experiencing Jesus. So
yeah.
Why isn't this on CNN? Why isn't it everywhere? And if you could tell people that, hey, if you live this life and you do healing works and you're good to others and you meditate, you can have this experience. That's what I want to communicate, and that's what the film The Voice hopefully does. And for those who don't believe, we have the scientists who tell you that we've scientifically verified that the Earth has an aura, that plants have auras. We can measure the aura of the human being. And when we're meditating, according to this new super aura camera, we can see that the energy field of the human body gets brighter and stronger. And this is all scientifically verified. So I put the science in there so that for those people who think, oh, this is just all hocus pocus and it's all in their minds, well, science doesn't lie. So there you go.
See, that's
University.
What I love about it. That's so important. Because all of us that have had these experiences, I bet there's only a few like you that have decided to do something about it and make a movie and tell people, hey, you can have this too. And that's why I love that you got the scientists in there and everything else, and that you're continuing to explore this through the science. Because it never occurred to me to do anything like that. It was
Valerie, is I'm having scientists say, oh my God, now that we know that this is enlightenment is real, we wish we were the ones practicing the meditation for as many years as we spent on our PhD, because we want to have those experiences too.
Exactly.
Because we've now proven to ourselves and the scientific community that it's real.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, when you think of Princeton University, where Einstein taught, that, you know, Dr. Roger Nelson has been measuring the aura of the Earth for 20 years, and this is in my film, The Voice, and this is where Einstein talks. Einstein said there's no room in this new physics for both the field and matter, for the field is the only reality. And then Einstein said, anyone who becomes seriously involved in the pursuit of science becomes convinced that a spirit, not a force, not electricity, a spirit is manifest in the laws of the universe, a spirit vastly superior to that of man. A scientist, Einstein, was convinced that the universe was alive and conscious, and that he was then, oh my God, you know, again, why isn't the scientific community in uproar over this? Why aren't they all talking about the conscious universe on CNN? Because they're afraid.
Well, they're starting afraid to. They're just being quiet about it. They're just trying to make it acceptable so that they don't get drummed out of their professions, basically. They have to kind of, you know, put the kid gloves on when they're talking about this stuff and make sure that they all agree on the terminology.
Right. Well, the funny thing is, you know, I was reading this book, Gino Serge, who won the Nobel Prize in Physics. He writes in his book, Faust in Copenhagen, which is about the early days and the first conferences. They did the fifth conference at Solvay Conference on Physics in Brussels, Belgium, 1927, people. Heisenberg and Niels Bohr come to Einstein and say, it looks like the minds of the researchers are affecting the results of the experiments. So we knew this in 1927 that the mind was over matter. It had the power over matter. And yet today, people think that's hokey science. When Einstein knew this in 1927, and then he makes his famous statement about the big spirit in the universe, vastly superior to that of man, and people don't see it. They think, oh, well, maybe Einstein's just philosophizing now. Well, he's philosophizing because they actually saw the proof that if the human mind can affect the position and the angular momentum of an electron spinning around a proton, then what does the big mind do?
Mm-hmm.
It creates a universe and galaxies and all kinds of heavens. It does all this amazing, miraculous stuff. And the voices of the angels are the voices, and hence the name of my film, The Voice. Those are the voices that are causing and sustaining creation. Thomas Aquinas said, I can think of no one who would disagree that the voices of the angels are the cause of the creation of the stars, what he called the celestial spheres, the stars and the planets.
Yeah. And, you know, I can remember hearing all these sounds, you know, and at one stage you hear what sounds like angelic chorus, and then you hear the deeper sounds.
Mm-hmm.
And you know that those are the sounds of creation, the sounds of the planets moving, and it's an incredible symphony. And
when Pythagoras heard it too. I mean, here's Pythagoras, the great Greek mathematician, who gave us trigonometry and the intervallic system that led to modern music and classical music, and he's saying he had the same experience. He heard the music of the cosmos, and he said anyone who purifies their faculties, their senses, can have this experience and hear this. They hear the music of the cosmos. So I look also at, with compassion, all the people who have drug addictions, who are doing hallucinogens and harmful things to their bodies, that they really do want to get out of the box of the mind, but that is not the way to do it. The way to do it is to never touch that stuff. It just destroys you and makes you sick. Learn to meditate properly. And these experiences are yours, and they'll make all your drug experiences look boring, utterly boring. It's kind of like reinvigorating the vision to me of the saints, that they may have been wearing brown rags and robes and had their heads down, but this is where they were. Their minds were in the cosmos.
Mm-hmm.
So.
Awesome. Well, we are out of time. This has been fascinating. We are out of time. You are going to have...
We're out of time.
Yeah, we're totally out of time.
We're beyond time.
That's right. Hopefully everybody else will be soon, too. And we need to talk about the water and the voice and Mona Lisa's little secret and all that kind of stuff. So this was like part one of the David Sirita interviews. So we can get deeper into this stuff, with the subsequent ones. And,
yeah, water and the voice... And Water and the Voice and Mona Lisa's Little Secret are at voiceentertainment.net on the internet for those of you who are interested in seeing our DVDs. I did not produce Water. I am co-distributing it with Intention Media. Betsy Chase from What the Bleep Do We Know is my co-partner, and Jim Law and my wife Crystal. We're distributing Water in America, and it a profound film. So thank you, Valerie, for having me on your show.
Oh, you bet. Thank you for being on. I really thank you so much for sharing your story about what you went through and what you found out. It's vitally important, and the listeners have been talking about on the fast chat, and they want you to know how much they appreciate that you came on to talk about this and to let them know that this is real. And,
it's,
you know,
all real. It's
yeah.
all worth it. You know, just keep practicing. And, you know, I have meditation CDs on my site for people who want to learn how to meditate, and deep relaxation meditation, insight meditation, seven energy centers breathing meditation. And I'm also going to, in the new year, be doing some consulting for people who need help with, you know, getting oriented into a practice that will work for them. Because not all meditations work for everybody. It's a very hard... It took me a long time to find the exact meditations that work really well, that are very, you know, the designed for different types of individuals.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I agree. I am not into the usual, you know, like I've never really been attracted to the whole, you know, sitting in the lotus position, you know, thing. I probably tend more towards Buddhist than I do the Hindu, but I found that the ultra-mind type meditation works best for me because I like to be busy, you know.
Mm-hmm.
I like to accomplish things when I'm sitting and meditating. But, yeah, people really need to know what's going to work for them, how they're wired. And so
Everybody's wired differently, so they may be practicing the wrong meditation. Like if you're not getting results doing a certain practice, then you're either doing the practice incorrectly or it's the wrong practice for you, and you have to explore some other techniques until you find one that really resonates with it for you.
Absolutely.
I mean, it's actually possible to do deep relaxation and relax your way all the way to God if you can really get that one. I mean, you have to let go from the inside out all the way. I mean, when you're relaxing on all the different levels of consciousness, and there's a way... You know, ultimately, the deepest meditation is deep relaxation, but it's incredible relaxation, and that's in my deep relaxation CD. It is simply about total let go of everything, which includes forgiving, letting go, and tuning, relaxing so deeply that you just dissolve into the God force. So I guess we're out of time. So
let me mention your website again. It's www.voiceentertainment.net. And you guys, if you didn't write that down, don't worry. Just go to my info portion on the page, and it's all listed there. And that way, at least you can see what David's got there that might be able to help you out with your meditative practice. And definitely check out the DVDs. And we'll have to schedule to have you on again next month, David, because then we could sit down and talk about the movies.
Yeah, we can talk about Mona Lisa's Little Secret, too, and some future stuff that I'm working on, and quantum jewelry coming next. And,
awesome.
Great things coming up.
Very cool. Well, thank you so much for being on, and I thought that this would be a nice thing, you know, to bring people into the holiday season and to remind them about what this whole season is about, which is compassion.
Yeah.
And so I think that you've done a great job of that. Thank you so much for being on. I really appreciate it. And I know the listeners did, because they were just sitting here going, gosh, wow. So that's a lot of fun. All right. So thank you so much for being on.
Good night.
Listeners, thank you for tuning in. And I know that you enjoyed listening to David, because I can see that on the fast chat. So thank you for tuning in. And as always, until next week, be happy, be healthy, and be who you really are. Nighty-night.